Welcome to the Andrew D'Angelo podcast.
Constant Constance. Each week, Andrew, renowned jazz saxophonist and brain cancer survivor, invites us to look at the many worlds of his guests with conversations that cover all the arts, human resilience, a little bit of politics, and a lot of humour.
You can't fail to have a fantastic time.
Hey everyone, how are you doing today? I'm here with my friend Brian Tate, who is a musician, singer, artist, and dare I say, lyricist. I mean, you are a lyricist, right, Brian? I mean, yes.
I'm probably a lyricist more than any of those other things.
Okay, fair enough. And I first met you, I didn't first meet you then, but we did a project, or you had me do a project with you, which, by the way, oh, I get it. I still have the brain.
The brain, man.
Yeah, my brain, man.
That's awesome.
The project with the Queen's Council on the Arts, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Crossing Arts. What was that called?
Queen's Art Express 2012, QAX 2012. And this was a big borough-wide celebration of everything that's great about Queens culture. The art, the food, the people. And they brought me on to basically develop that idea and put something together. And so what I put together was this, this festival that focused, that highlighted four neighborhoods. So three or four neighborhoods, but celebrated the entire borough. And in each of the showcase neighborhoods, we did a project called What If We Made a New World? It was imagining the world if artists decided public policy.
Wow.
And you were part of the, so in Long Island City, we did a night and we created these collaborative teams of artists. I love doing that.
Yeah.
In Long Island City, we did a night that asked what if artists decided economic policy?
That would be amazing. That would be so amazing.
That was, and that night was hot. That was with Chanel Kennebrew, Leslie Alfin, Teresa Burns, and Toshi Reagan. And each of them had an area in this space where they did work around if artists decided economic policy. And then out in Jamaica, to Jamaica Center for Arts and Learning. We have four other artists, Carlos Martinez, Anna Jensen, Queen Gades, and Ruang Ha. And they did a piece around if artists decided housing policy. So you were part of the group that was out in Flushing,
right,
at a gallery called Crossing Arts.
Yeah, right, in Flushing.
And that night was what if artists decided healthcare policy.
Right.
And that was you, and that was
Teresa was on that too, I think.
No.
No? Are you sure? Okay.
No. That was you, that was DJ Reka. That was
well, don't yell at me. I just thought Teresa was on it. That's all. You're like, no, man, no, no. Well, I'm just saying, that's what I thought.
That was you came out to the thing in Long Island City.
Okay.
And you saw Teresa perform where she was like the money tree thing, and she was like,
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. All right, correct, stand corrected, but geez.
That was you, Ocean Morrison.
Oh yeah, Ocean, yeah. Ocean, how was Ocean?
Now, Lisa Jessie Peterson came in at the end, and she did the thing around, like the holistic food lady who was advising people to poop throughout the day or something. And also, it was you, Ocean, Lisa, and DJ Raker. And that was a killer night. And so you did the thing with the brain,
right,
with the brain to play music. All of y'all did phenomenal stuff, man. But we didn't know each other then. I did a bunch of research to find the right people, you know, for this idea. And, you know, it's funny, I hadn't thought about this before right now, Andrew, but it's also very similar to how I write music. But we can talk about that later. But
go ahead.
I researched and found you, and I was like, this cat's amazing, you know, and your music. And, you know, I was immediately like, Andrew D'Angelo, it's a bad mother F, man. We got to get this guy.
And he had fucking brain cancer, so there's that, right? I mean, I went through the healthcare system, you know, like in a, like some kind of, what do you call it? Some kind of, you know, I don't know, like filter or something. I went through so fast. It just all happened so fast for me. I was like, I had never been to the doctor in 20 years. I hadn't been in the hospital really ever. And then all of a sudden, here I am, you know, just like in it, and then I'm out of it. And then all of a sudden I'm doing this project and I'm making a brain. I'm putting my hand over here because the brain is over here, just so everybody knows. I can't see it, but it's over here. And I'm part of Medicare for All at this point, force the vote. Do you know anything about that or?
No.
Oh, well, most countries have healthcare for everybody. You don't have to have insurance. It's just all a part of living. And so we're doing our best to bring healthcare to everybody in the US so we don't have to pay our insurance, whatever it is, $500 a month.
Yeah.
So I was, and part of it was your project, by the way. I sent them your a video or a, maybe it was an article from that project.
Yeah, we got good press. I think there was TV and print. Yeah.
Right. I all of a sudden I'm spacing. I didn't know we were going to go here, but it's anyway, and Sharif and all these people at Medicare for All and Jimmy Dore and everybody is just like, why, you know, in Europe, when you go to Europe or, you know, Canada or wherever, you know, if you have to go to the doctor, you just go to the doctor. You don't have to worry about, well, your copay is $12,000 or whatever the case may be. So interesting. So we were talking about Medicare for All and the how we met. But what I guess I didn't realize at the time is your band Trying for the Black Madonna is really fucking good. And I love that drummer. Who is that drummer? You sent me those videos. Who's playing drums? Do you remember?
I don't remember his name.
Okay.
That's embarrassing.
That's bad, man. Like,
let me tell you something. Let me tell you something, man. Our founding drummer, the drummer who co-founded the band.
Yeah.
Unreal. Unreal. Woman out of Switzerland and very into like Latin music, Latin beats. She brought so much flavor and like just deftness to what we did. And we played with her for a long time and then.
Is there a name?
Medicola.
Okay.
And then she started a family and as she was pregnant with her second daughter, you know, it seemed like the wise thing to return to Switzerland after years of being in New York City. So we spent a long time trying to find another drummer. We're a bit unusual, I've learned, in New York City because, you know, we're like an actual band, you know, like this is the band. And it's not like straight people and, you know, pick up people. Nothing against that. It's just not, it's not the culture that we come out of. So me and the guys, man, we meet every week. When we were first playing, particularly when Medit was in the group, you know, for years, we would rehearse like 3 times a week.
Wow.
You know, and then just go out, kill it, come back, rehearse, you know, writing.
And nice.
And then, you know, we had that, you know, implosion period that all creative forces do, and didn't see each other, didn't engage for a long time. Until after I had heart surgery, which is something else that you said made me think about that. And then after that, we all got back together and recorded some stuff, and then met it had, that's when she was having a family, raising a family, and she had to split. So then we spent like a long time trying to find a drummer. We could not. And did a couple of shows with that cat. And he was good. I liked him, you know. But it was, you know, season, not a reason. And ultimately, though, we found our new drummer, who is like, right there, man, Don McKenzie, which I say lovingly, crazy ass Don McKenzie. That's my brother. and
nice. No, I mean, you know,
Don is a killer. Don is a killer, like a monster player, like just a monster player. And I grew up listening to drummers, you know, and you know Tony and Blakey, and Don is a monster drummer who can do most anything. And we did a couple shows with him and had some more lined up. And then pandemic. That was so, but the larger thing is after being with these guys, my brothers, every week, you know, for years. See, after the three times a week thing, and then we stopped playing for a minute. And then when we got back together, we would just see each other once a week. And when we get together once a week, we just, you know, half the time we're just sitting around bullshitting, you know, and talking smack at each other, about each other, whatever else. And then the last half of the session, we'd sit down and play some music, and it would just be like, because there was all of this chemistry, all of these years of like, you know, electric currents between us, that it didn't take a long time to lay something out and just have it like come fully, like woo. So we would just meet once a week, man. But it was just so, you know, it was food for the soul, old expression, but it's so true.
It's true. Now,
and now, sorry. Now, you know, one of the things that's been most notable and tough for me about the pandemic is I can't be with my guys, you know, even just aside from the music, just, you know, sharing that space together, you know, anyway.
Right. And I think that aspect, as you said, of being a band, as opposed to just hiring, you know, whoever for whatever gig,
yeah,
is something I've talked to a lot of people about over the years, where you can tell when somebody is playing a show, or at least I can, I believe I can, and they're just doing the gig, right? They're just trying to get through the gig because they're like, all right, this pays this amount of money. I just want to finish this thing up and, you know, get my paycheck. I'm sure I'm going to get some shit for that, Andrew meaning, but I don't care. But so it's, I've also had that fortunate experience of having a band. So I understand that, you know, for 31 years, I don't know if people get so crazy about timing, but it was like 30 something years. And so I understand that where you're doing it for a reason. And so, you know, when I heard the videos you sent me, I mean, I guess I was focused on you, but I also really liked the drummer. But yeah, maybe he wasn't listening. Maybe he just wanted to get through the gig.
He was cool.
Yeah, but he sounded really good to me. And I was like, if I get this guy and play with him, and even if he didn't listen to me, like if he was like a metronome, it would still sound fucking cool, you know, because I don't care.
Yeah. What I mean? No, he was cool, man. I'm embarrassed. I can't remember his name, but of course I can't.
It's remember. All right.
I can't remember.
I don't either.
Days. You know? Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So when it comes to when you're writing lyrics, and that song "Stupid," or Come On Now. Those are two songs. I mean, what are you thinking? I mean, do you write the title? Do you remember those songs that I'm talking about? Right. And so are you, I'm assuming you wrote the lyrics for those. Or are you improvising them on the spot?
So here's the thing.
Preach, man. Go ahead. So here's the thing.
Those two songs.
Second time I got yelled at in this interview, by the way, folks. I'm just telling you. Anyway.
So here's the thing, man, is that I grew up writing poetry.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, I would just sit with my notebook and I'd write poetry for days.
Wow.
And I did that for years, you know, and I would perform poetry, and we just had a visitor enter the
film. Yeah, I know, you just had a cameo, man. Photobomb. All right.
She's saying she's not here. I'm going to angle my head. She's saying hello.
Hey.
What's up?
Hi.
I have a cameo with the light on my. I can't get it out.
You see, I put this Bowie and Freddie Mercury's balls up in the front.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. That's
lovely. Anyway, so I would write poetry, man, and I was part of a performance poetry group, what they now call spoken word.
Right.
I was part of a poetry performance ensemble called Sabotage back in D.C. And, you know, we would get up and do our thing. And so I, you know, wrote a lot of poetry. And at the point at which I decided I wanted to sing, I felt that what I wanted to do was really focus on the musicality of I wanted to focus on the potential for musicality with my voice, not the words. I mean, that one would have to be foregrounded. And if one was going to be foregrounded, I wanted it to be the musicality of the voice instead of the words. You know what I mean? And maybe for some people, they don't have to be foregrounded. But I think of somebody like, you know, and it's like I've studied a lot of writers and studied a lot of musicians. It's just something that I do. And so when I think of somebody like Dylan, for example, you know, and studied a lot of Dylan, you know, the words for me are foregrounded. They're part of a whole. It's not that they're just out there on their own. They're part of a whole, you know. And those songs, man, like Blood on the Tracks, that stuff is just like mind-blowing. And the rhyme patterns and schemes that he would use there, it's just freaking mind-blowing. On the other hand, you have somebody who's also deeply poetic, like Al Green, you know, who I also listened to up and down growing up, and even still.
Right.
You know, it's just different. I think the folks have different relationships to the words, to the music, you know. So for me, who did not come from, you know, I never learned to play an instrument. In my mind, and I emphasize this to not say that this is actual or factual, I'm just saying that in my mind, I had to choose what I was going to foreground if I wanted to, like, you know, make music. And what I wanted to foreground was not my words, it was the musicality, it was the delivery. Anyway, all of which is to say, I went down that path. And, you know, so what I, once I started to figure out my voice, you know, my approach to the music, you know, once I finally started to, like, land on something after years of, like, you know, started to figure something out, the methodology that I came upon, that I developed. And mind you, I just want to reiterate, I would spend I'd spend an inordinate amount of time writing poems.
I mean, so first of all, if you don't mind to explain to me, I don't care about my audience, but could you explain foreground? And when you say in amount of, how much time are we talking about here? 8 hours a day, your every waking moment, or?
When I was writing poetry, I was younger, so I didn't have as many commitments and distractions.
Right.
Yeah, I'd probably spend, could easily spend like 6 hours a day just, writing and thinking through, what goes where. And I wrote some stuff that still lives, that's still alive for me today, Once I started writing music, though, what I came to as a methodology is that I would write out the vocal melodies, like their horn charts.
So you're actually notating that music?
Only in my mind.
Okay, fair enough. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is like, is this notated or is it just...
For a while I was notating it. The guys, they could give a shit. It didn't make any difference.
Right.
And it would take me so long to notate it, but I would, for a time I was writing like for other instruments besides my voice, And then I just decided, screw that. Let me just, anyway. So I write a vocal melody, I have an idea for a song. I have a title. And then I write the vocal melody. And then I write the words to fit that melody.
Interesting. Okay.
So instead
that's
of...
That's your process, right?
Instead of what it seemed to me that other people who would come to music to write poetry would do, is you write a poem and then you put the poem to music. And that foregrounds the poem, the lyrical content of the poem. I go the other route. I write the music, and then I create the poem to fall within the music. So the thing that made me think about that was when we talked about how you and I met. I had a vision for what I wanted to do with that project. What if we made a new world? Artists decided public policy. And I had several creative prompts. There was this commercial, there was a TV campaign for, I can't remember the product now. That's because I can't remember them. But they did all these things about like, what if roadies ran the world, and what if this, these kind of people ran the world, what have you. But it was all advertisements to market their product. And it was like, oh, wow. But it was like, it was really convincingly done. And so I was thinking, oh yeah, man, what if artists like decided public policy? So kind of riffed on that. And there were other points of, there are other creative prompts up in there. But once I had this idea, once I had the title of the thing, what if we made a new world, once I had an idea, and how I would, we'll do stuff in these neighborhoods. And then this is how we solve the issue of presenting stuff across the borough. We'll do this big website. So I had all of these, infrastructure.
Right.
Then I had to have people who could give it life, because otherwise it's just ideas. So that meant researching and finding, if we're talking about healthcare, who are artists who are doing stuff around that?
Yeah, but why not?
That's how I found.
Why not just do it yourself? That's what I don't know. Why not just, take your band, your project, your lyricism, your poetry, and do it yourself? You seem to be I just think you have this ability to help people collaborate, which is something I appreciate about you. And I still do, even then 10 years later, or whatever it's been, 8 years, I don't know, we can argue about the timing, but it's just been amazing to watch you bring people together to collaborate to affect the world in a positive way. And that's something I love about you. And whether that's through your music, and I'm very curious if you've ever used your music to influence anti-racism or healthcare or, you know, anything like that, because you just, look, man, I just think you have this ability to bring people together. That's what I think you have. You can argue with me, anybody else can be mad at me or whatever, but I'm just wondering if, because a lot of people make it singular, right? It's about me, man. I'm gonna like do it myself, man. I'm gonna, you know, make change myself. But somehow you're always just putting your arms out there and hugging all of us. And you were really nice to me. And I think you're really nice to Teresa and Ocean and everybody. And I don't know how they feel about it, but I was just like, oh, that was really a lovely experience, you know, that I'm holding on to with my brain. My brain over here, everybody, my brain.
Okay.
My brain. And it's, anyway, I just want to say thank you on some level, but also, is that something that you do consciously, or is it just like a organic response, you know?
Both. I'm compelled to do that.
And so is there like a voice in the back of your head going, man, you got to do this, or, you know, like
there
when
you're now.
Right. What do you mean by that? Like things have changed, or?
Well, so, things have changed. I mean, things evolve. I think that for each person, particularly creative people, you know, your practice evolves. But I think all of us evolve, you know. When I first started doing this work, I'm wondering if I should close my window. Does it matter? It's okay for you.
I don't. It's not bothering me. But
okay,
you know,
that's cool.
It's like ambient noise.
So when I first started doing this work, the work of, you know, creating platforms and creating stages and opportunities for people to, you know, come present. This felt like the most natural thing in the world to me. And it wasn't a question of, it's never been a question for me of, let me put myself up there. You know, my mind just doesn't work that way. You know, when I was doing, when I was doing the band and I would book shows, you know, for the band, I would always try to find other bands to create shows with, you know, and right. We invited a lot of bands on the shows. And, you know, I guess part of it is I've always felt that the way to do something, to create, create change, or, you know, just really be present, is to punch above your weight, do something greater than yourself, you know, and be a part of something that's bigger and greater than yourself. And that's part of the thing about being in a band, you know, like having a band. It's like you're part of something. It's like each of the individual parts are like, you know, phenomenal, but the thing together, it's like combustible, you know. And, you know, I was listening to AC/DC the other night, walking down the street. I hadn't listened to AC/DC in a long time. And I mean, it's like with the original singer, Bon Scott.
Right.
And I was listening to Highway to Hell. And there's a line where he says, hey, Satan, paid my dues, playing in a rocking band. Hey, mama, look at me. I'm on my way to the promised land. I'm on the highway to hell. Fucking poetry, man. But it's that idea of like, yeah, man, pay my dues, singing in a rocking band, you know. So that idea of like being a part of something greater than oneself. So the projects are an extension of that, you know. It's like, and I see so much greatness in other people, you know. I mean, I saw so much greatness in you just reading about you. And then when we met and all of that, and it's just like, oh man, it's still, you know, the other thing I should tell you is that I grew up reading comic books, Marvel comic books, you know.
Okay.
So as a boy, I was exposed to, like, you know, old school, man, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, you know, those early stages of like Fantastic Four and the X-Men and the Avengers and all of that shit. So some part of me processes people in that way, you know? So it's like when I meet people who have like a certain kind of, it's not, and it's not just like an energy or a charisma, you know?
A demeanor or something like that? Not to put words in your mouth, but no.
No, no, no.
All right. Third time I've been corrected on the show, ladies and gentlemen, but okay.
Actually, some of those things I'm a bit like wary of.
Okay.
Right. You know, I can be a bit wary when like...
What the hell's going on over there?
It's, you know, Brooklyn. I can be a bit wary when people... well, let me just say that I'm not talking about persona, you know. I don't really care about persona. I'm just talking about being open to and attuned to a person's sense of values and yeah. So, and each person's values are like, you know, are expressed and held in different ways. And so when I met you, and same when I've met other people, it's just like, oh, wow, man. You know, that cat is like freaking, you know, fucking Cyclops, man. But it's like in this sort of mythic narrative, like, you know, comic book kind of way. And it's like, oh shit. So to me, the most natural thing in the world is, oh yeah, man, let's, you know, let me do everything I can to help like train that light on this cat, man. And maybe bring him together with her and with him, and like, fuck, man, it'd be fucking amazing.
You're like a connector, as I say. Like, you're one of those people that brings people together. And I mean, if that's fair. And like, I mean, Mike, if I had a comic book narrative, be like, don't fucking fuck with my fucking brain. I do the fuck what I want, you motherfuckers. Fuck you. I get to have my lamps in the background. I could have my hair long. I could have the light the way I want. Fuck you, right? Damn. And Brian, you let me do what I want to do. And I think that's one of the things I love about you is you're like, all right. So that was kind of a rant. Sorry, I did a rant. I apologize. I did a rant.
No, look, man, I'm going to tell you, you know, the projects that I do, I don't talk about them before they're cooked because, you know, I like that JB thing, kill them and leave. It's like you bring this shit out and say, bam, you know? So.
Nice.
But I also, you know, the other time I talk about my projects is if I've decided not to do them. So I'm going to cheat this a little bit because I've had two projects that I've had you in mind for, man. And I'll share one of them because I just don't know if I can, I don't know that I can do it. And I haven't actively thought about it for a while, but I wanted to do a thing with you. And I want to say it was called Anthem, but it might've had a different title. I think it did have a different title, but it was, I wanted to commission you. I wanted to have you commissioned to create a piece of work for the 9/11 Museum and to be like an artist in residence at the 9/11 Museum and to create this piece of work. It was not called Anthem, it was called...
Whatever, dude, all I know about you is that you're fluid. And what that's one thing I loved about you is like, if somebody wants to change the title of their project or like, you know, shift over here, which I did, I can speak to myself, but I also think other people in the QAX project, we did the Queens project, where people were like, yeah, I think I want to call it something else. You're like, all right, that's cool. You're always cool with that. So I'm not surprised that you're not nailing, you know, the titles of these things, because I think you're open to people being okay with, all right, you're an artist. What do you want to do now?
I think the reason I'm not nailing the title of the thing is because my mind is like gone. But
I don't think it is. I don't think your mind is gone.
Talking with a friend. I was talking with a friend a couple of days ago, a visual artist, was telling me about a grant process, you know, and how they want letters of recommendation just in the course of the application, you know, and how he felt that this was just so like, it's fucking bullshit, man. You know, you got to go to people over and over. We write a letter of recommendation. And I said, you know what? Listen, man, you can come to me 100 times. It's never too much.
Right. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You're cool with that.
But I do want to say, you get this foundation, you know, Arts Foundation, and you require every applicant to submit letters of reference from, you know, letters of recommendation from 3 different people. And you get like, you know, however many applications you get, a shitload. You know right away, okay, these people are out because of some technical thing or some, you know, whatever. But 40% of these people are out. Okay, now let's look at the work. Okay. So 20% of these people, it just ain't there. Either it's not what we're looking for, or, you know, we don't feel that it's at a certain level. So they're out. So now it comes to like a hardcore competitive thing about, you know, 30%, maybe it's 15% of the people. Why not require those people to write, to gather these letters? Why put artists in all of these freaking hoops? For something that's never even going to get through the gate.
Right.
And I'm just like, you know what? You have the money. Write the artist a check. And this whole question of, well, what are they going to do with the money? Write the check to the artist.
Yeah, they're going to pay. They're going to pay rent and pay the bills.
Whatever they're going to do is going to be the right thing. So just get out of the freaking way. Create the opportunity. Whatever you're doing, if it's bread, if it's a stage, if it's visibility, and get out of the effing way.
It's funny because when you think about it, if let's say just as spitball, there's like 10 people that apply and they have to get 3 recommendations. So that's 30 pieces of whatever each panelist has to read, right?
And they're not even going to read it because
if the person doesn't
match up with what they're looking for.
Exactly. And it's like, in the end, what is it for? A grand, maybe 10 grand, you know, whatever.
Oh, it's the other side of it. Yeah. Then you got to do all of this like bullshit reporting and so forth. And I'm just correct. Like, write the people a check. Just
write, just write the fucking check. Oh my God.
So my feeling about like artists, when I engage artists and stuff I'm doing, it's like, here's a big picture. What are you going to do? Do you think? How can I be in service to that?
God bless you for that. I mean, my own mom, early in 2020 in the pandemic, she's like, can I send you some money? I'm like, sure. So she sent me $1,000, right? And so there was my phone bills, like $100. My internet's like $100, you know, my rent. That's it. Money's gone. I was like, thanks for, you know, I mean, thank you, mom. God bless you. But and it's my mom. I didn't have to prove anything to her, right? I didn't have to write a grant or anything. What, am I being too exposing here?
No.
I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with this world? It's so weird.
I want to tell you something. I want to tell you something. And I want to use my words slightly. I want to be slightly discreet. Not too much, but slightly discreet. Okay. So I brought you into something else. and the situation got all fucking crazy. We've never really talked about that.
Are you talking about the Greenwood Cemetery thing?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to be discreet about, but that's fine. Yeah, the Greenwood Cemetery thing. But you know, like, here's the thing, is it? And that's a perfect example of, like, I had this vision. I had this vision as soon as I saw the cemetery. It's like, wow, effing amazing. So, you know, I was met with hunches that were, I think, in all fairness, outside of anybody's control, you know. And it had only to do, you know, largely to do with me. You know, I just started this gig, which was like the first time I worked a gig in a long time. And that was different. And also, you know, my mom had just passed, and I hadn't factored in until later, oh, this is one of the reasons I was so attached to doing this thing at the cemetery. I hadn't really put that together then. But it's a case where my response to artists doing stuff is as we've discussed. One of the things that I learned on that gig was that sometimes a presenter, that's not where their head is, you know? And they have their own set of, like, you know, we need this to happen this way, we need that to happen that way, and so forth and so on. So that were, you know, there were some things that in the course of that gig, there were some really beautiful, gorgeous things that happened, but there are other just aspects of it that were outside of how I like to do things, you know? And So I just want to tell you that I loved what you did with that thing. I don't know if I ever told you that. The first night that you did that, man, I just sat there in the front row and I was crying. You know, I mean, I was literally crying. And it was just so like, and you played this thing that you've recorded. There was maybe a thing for your uncle.
I Love You, is that what you're talking about?
Probably. And it's like when I'm like doing a gig, I'm constantly on the move. I'm like moving all the time. It's only recently in the last few years that I have tasked myself to stop being a service. Everything is set up. Just sit down and take this in. And I did that in your set, that first or second night that you did it, man. And I was just freaking weeping. So I thought the stuff you did was completely fucking beautiful. And I thought that whole thing, it had such power to it. And, I would love to have a space like that where I could be completely like what you described about my process. But that wasn't that room. And I didn't fully understand the degree to which they were operating in a different lane until we were like pretty far down the lane. So, you know, it happens that way.
Live and learn. I mean,
live and learn.
I've actually been in contact with Greenwood Cemetery about that concert recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, on Twitter. And
wow.
I showed them some photos and they were super psyched. But yeah.
That's great. Let me tell you something else. Let me tell you something else that's really important to me.
Okay.
Is when I go into like institutional doors, you know, like big institutional doors, which I do a fair amount. You know, I enjoy that. And I'm there for a purpose. You know, I'm there to like do the people's work. But one of the other things that I do, that I always try to do, is I try to open doors for other people to come in. Come on in, come on in, come on in. You know, and create their own relationships. Hey, this is so-and-so. Do you know so-and-so? They're like, this killer shit. Hey, so-and-so, this is, you know, to like the big wigs at the whatever this institution is. You need to know Andrew. You need to know Ed. He's this killer photographer. He's going to take all the photos for our thing. You need to know so-and-so, so-and-so. So that when I leave, which is inevitable, other people have their own relationships now and can like do shit. It's good for everybody that way. So I'm glad to hear that you're in contact with Greenwood, and I hope y'all do something, because that would be like the grandest win for me out of that freaking gig, man.
I don't know if they're going to invite me to do something. Do you know did I ever tell you the story of my cell phone that night, my mobile phone? So it was the last night we played there, okay? And I don't know if that was the greatest night of my personal set with you. I think Vernon Reed sounded great every night. But so anyway, I lost my cell phone.
Oh.
Because I wandered through the cemetery and found an exit and got a car service and went home. And I got home and I realized I lost my mobile phone. And I was like, oh shit. And only because my neighbor's like 100 years old, I need my phone to stay in touch with her. So I walked to the cemetery. It's about maybe 9 in the morning or something like that. And I talked to the guy at the gate and I say, hey, I played a show here last night. And he looks at me like, what are you talking about? You played a show here last night, right? And I think I left my phone. Remember you had those tents set up, the kind of temporary tents?
Yeah, the hospitality tents.
And I said, but I don't remember exactly where, because you had somebody take us up in a golf cart or whatever it was. So I don't know how to get there.
Yeah.
He goes, just walk up there, you'll find it. So I walk up there, whatever that means, and I'm walking on the grass and stuff, and then there's my phone. I found my phone.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. And the guy at the gate was literally, I mean, in his 60s, understandably, no problem. But he was like, what the hell are you talking about? But then he goes, just, you know, walk up there, you'll find it. I was like, walk up there where? He goes, just over there. And I just walked and walked, and then I found it in the grass. I found my phone, which, you know, phones are like $1,000 these days or whatever, 800 back then or something. But I have a serious bond with that.
That's magical, man. It's a magical place.
I think it's magical. And I put that on the Greenwood Cemetery website, and I got no responses. I was like, that's kind of depressing. I thought it was kind of a cool story, but, you know, whatever. Maybe they think I'm making it up, but I'm not.
But you know, I think that there's magic in places, there's magic in people, there's magic in moments.
Agreed. You know?
And when there's an opportunity to combine those things, it's a really powerful thing. But just even, you know, it doesn't have to be on some big grand level. I lean towards big grand shit, but it doesn't have to be on a big grand level. You know,
if we could shift gears just for a minute at the end of the show and talk a little bit about racism in America. And here we are in the crux of the Derek Chauvin trial, of the murder of Charles Floyd, and then also the George Floyd. Sorry, I was getting confused, man.
There's a lot of people been murdered. I you know.
I don't know if Charles Floyd was ever dealt and Dante Wright. And then I grabbed this quote from something you sent me. Why should it be up to people of color to educate me about racism? That sounds exhausting. If there are white folks around who can get me started and keep me grounded. I don't really understand what that means.
Is that a quote from Dan James?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So okay. Here I am talking to a person of color about racism. So there's that, you know.
Okay, that's fine.
I mean, should I be talking to other white people about racism, or I don't know?
I don't think there's any reason you shouldn't be.
Okay. And I do. And that white person said, were you always aware of your Black identity? Has that identity changed over the years?
This is something that a white person said to you for you Correct. To ask me.
Correct. Direct question to you after several phone calls and texts and stuff like this.
Tell me your question again. Was I always aware of my Black identity? Or is that
Were you always aware of your Black identity? And has that identity changed over the years?
Wow. Well, I want to answer your question, but I also want, and I'll say and instead of but, I also want to address something that is, it may be separate and apart from the question, but it's part of a larger context for me from which the question springs.
Okay.
So let me respond to your question. Have I always been aware of my Black identity? One word answer is yes. The next answer is, you know, I'm in a society, we all are, in which race is one of the defining characteristics of who gets to live, who gets to die, who gets to enjoy, who's made to suffer. I mean, so many of those things are defined by race. They're not defined uniquely by race. The race is up there. Race may be, it may be, it's like it's right in the core material, you know. So have I always been aware of my race? But that wasn't the question. The question was, I always been aware of my race or of my Black identity. My Blackness is not, it's not an identity. And I don't want to parse this too closely, like into a thing of semantics, because I don't know that that's what the person who asked you to ask me that question meant it. But I'm going to take it this way just for a minute.
It was a white female, straight female.
That's fine. It's not an identity. I mean, so this kind of circles back to the discussion we were having that we touched on briefly about persona, you know, which is a term I brought into the conversation, in which I said that I'm not responding to people's personas. I'm responding to their essence, you know, is what I want to be attuned to, is someone's essence. And, you know, and I also said that I can be a bit wary of people who have a certain, you know, how can I put this?
Shouldn't I say qua?
Well, you know what? But see, if that's part of an essence, then it's just, then it's like a beautiful thing. If it's something that's adopted for a purpose, you know, if I can be like, you know, this person, then I can, you know, acquire this. Or if I'm that kind of person, I can get her or him. Or, you know, if I'm this, you know, those are things that I associate with the persona. And from an artistic standpoint, particularly from a musician standpoint, which, you know, typically involves performance, I'm very like sensitive to when I see especially singers who are performing, and it's like all of this like shine is on them. And it's like, and it's just different strokes with different folks. I'm talking about myself here, that I wanna like be in the company of people who give, not people who take. Anyway, so I'm connecting, and this may not be at all what your friend intended with her question,
No intention. Open question.
I'm connecting identity with.
She's married to a black man, and she was like, "I just want to know what he has to say." That's it.
Okay, you're taking this deeper and deeper, but let me just stay in this lane for a second. I'm equating, and perhaps unfairly, I'm equating identity with persona. Okay. And I'm distinguishing persona from essence. Okay. My persona is something that I could change. My essence is who I am. My identity is not a, my blackness is not an identity. It's who I am. It's cooked in with the lasagna. It's like, it's all there. And I would go so far as to, I would add to that. You know, have I always been aware of my black identity? I've always been aware of my my identity as a boy and then a man. I've been aware of my identity. There's certain things that, you know, I became more aware of over time, but like being an able-bodied person. I mean, our society is divided in such a way that there's a hierarchy. You know, if you are white, if you are man, if you're straight, if you're able-bodied, if you have a certain physical presentation, you know, those five things, you're already over here. You know, so for people who are not within that camp, and particularly when other people, when the people who are in that camp have created the society in such a way that everybody else is made to be less, is to have less and to think of themselves as less and to be, you know, whatever, just all of that myth, the myth of white supremacy. I think that we're always, everyone is aware of who they are. I have no illusions about that. And not only am I aware of it, I embrace it. I'm thrilled to be who I am, every aspect of who I am. I also have a tremendous amount of empathy and curiosity about other people and their conditions and their sense of self.
Let me interrupt just for a sec. But she was more asking, I mean, since you were a kid, you had that awareness, or did it change over time? That was more of a question. Maybe I got more direct with the question because I wrote it down in a way.
Well,
I mean, when you're like five, do you understand that? Or when you're like 10 or 15, you know, or 25? Or?
I mean, you know, let me address something that I think is universal about children. I think that up until, I don't know, there's probably an age, I'll just tell you the age that comes to mind for me, up until like you're 7, 8, maybe while you're still like in the single numbers, as a general, with lots of variation across people and whatever.
Okay.
The world you see is the world it is. There's no questioning of it. This is the world. And for hopefully, if you're in the camp of, you know, what I hope to think is a good number of people, the world is good, man. You know, now, as you get older, you may see, oh, shit, man, we were like dirt poor. Or, oh, shit, it's not normal to, like, get your ass kicked every day. Or, you know, oh, God, you know, other people, like, they, like, have food. They have, like, meals, like, 2 or 3 times a day. whatever it is, whatever the thing is,
whatever.
Right, but when you're young, wow, you know, it's not like that for everybody, not by far, but for a good number of children in America, at least, I think, I hope, you know, the situation you grow up in is the situation you grow up in. The life you grow up in is the life you grow up in. And it's not a comparing against this or that because, fuck, you're a child. So as a child, as a black child.
Sorry.
As a black child, I mean, you know, I grew up in a household where my parents were very, you know, my parents were freedom fighters. They were very active in civil rights movement, black power movement, Pan-African movement, black nationalism, and not in an abstract or in a cerebral way, although in that way also, but I mean in a real activist way. And so I grew up surrounded by examples and thinking and books and images of black empowerment and black pride, you know. It's just the most natural thing in the world to me. But I also think that just taking that aside, you know, I grew up reading comic books. I grew up watching horror movies. I mean, it was just the natural, most natural thing in the world to me. And it wasn't like, oh, you know, other people aren't watching movies where, you know, Dracula's decapitating somebody. Right. You know, I watch those movies all the time. And, you know, it's just growing up.
I mean, I guess from my side, like, it just seems like there should be no reason for a child to have to think about this shit. And then my friend, and again, I did a good job of keeping this away from you because I wanted to, like, put you on the spot. And I'm sorry, you don't seem angry, so you seem cool. And it's just like, I mean, she was just curious. Like, I mean, did your identity change as you grew up?
Well, let me go to the other part of this though.
Yeah,
what I said was, you know, what I think is a larger context from which the question springs.
Okay.
So two qualities that are hugely important to me, two values that are hugely important to me in my life, are empathy and curiosity. And in that constellation of values and feelings and so forth is also doubt and uncertainty, you know. And I have a real wariness, Andrew, of people who are like certain. That to me is like fucking yellow light flashing to red, you know? I place a huge value in doubt and uncertainty, you know? And I often say, like when I'm doing these projects, when I'm doing anything, what I know could fill a thimble, but I do have a tremendous amount of curiosity and empathy. And I never feel that there's anything wrong with asking about something, you know, that I don't know about. But I will tell you this. I think that it's imperative. This isn't where I was going to go, but I'm in this lane, so I'm going to stay in this lane for a second. Okay. I was doing a project to talk about what the world was like, what America was like, what the future held for people who were gay after the 2016 election. And so I researched and found, you know, four gay activists, creative people, thinkers from different cultural communities, and reached out to them the same way I reached out to you for that other project.
Right.
To say, hey, I want to do this public conversation. You know, would you come and talk about the work that you're doing? Would you come and talk about what you see happening in the world right now? And
what you see is coming up and so forth. And each one of these people said, yeah, you know. Another part of my curatorial and my creative practice is that everybody gets paid. Right. I don't do shit if people ain't going to get paid. I don't have to be paid. But if I'm bringing anybody to the table, folks have to be paid. So when I'm reaching out to people, part of that conversation also is, here's the thing, here's the vision, here's where I'm coming from, and you're going to get paid. So I reached out to these folks and said, hey, would you all do this thing? And they, yeah, and everybody said, yeah. And these aren't people who even know each other. It's just, you know, it's
part you're of connecting people. That's what you do.
Yeah. So I wrote a curatorial statement to express, and I did a lot, you know, I wrote a curatorial statement to express my position as someone who's not gay, but not to express my position, to really frame this issue and why this discussion was important, you know, in my mind. And so I wrote this curatorial statement and I shared it with the people who were going to appear on this panel.
Right.
Before I made it public. Say, could you give me your thoughts about this? You know, because fuck do I know? You know, I don't want to put something out there that's whack. It's got
Right. Like, what do you know? What do I know about, you know, racism? I mean, what, right?
So I put this thing out, I send it to them, and I said, so this is a curatorial statement, it's like three paragraphs. I just want to, you know, please tell me, you know. And folks got back to me and said, yeah, yeah, man. No, that's right on. Yeah, yeah, man. That's great. Yeah, yeah. And one person responded privately and she said, Brian, yeah, that, your statement, that was really good. It's just one thing. I just want to, okay, yeah, well, what is it? Anything. She said, the part where you say that people should not be persecuted, or I can't remember the language that I use, because of their gender preference. And I said, oh, okay. And I heard it. I heard it. Gender preference. Because it ain't a preference. See, I'm outside of it. And the culture says it's a preference.
Right.
And in all innocence, I'm like, gender preference. Which means that a person could prefer something else if they chose. Right. You know, the way that somebody else might, I prefer to go to dinner here. So I'm, in all innocence, I'm using this language. It is a language of, it's not a language of humanity. It was innocent. I didn't know. So I said, and she said, it's just, you know, so this expression where you say gender preference, I got you. Now, that's not the, that's not, that for me, that's not the interesting part, although that's interesting. Fortunately, because of another experience I had the presence of mind to say to her, because my next, the question I was about to ask is, what is the better way to say this? But I didn't say that. What I said to her was, let me research some things and come back to you with some other language. And she said, okay. And I researched, I did the work, I invested the time, I applied myself, and I came back and I said to her, so if this language said, oh, well, gender orientation, yeah, that's fine.
Wow.
Because what I did not do was make it her job to tell me what it's supposed to say. I'm supposed to do that work. If you, and I liken it, I put it like this. If you're applying for a gig of any type, you know, in the straight world, what I call the straight world of, you know, people in offices and that shit, or in the, you know, the creative world, you know, the bent world, whatever you want to call it. You know, you want to get in a, you know, you be on a show. You
Let's call it the curved world. How's that?
I like that. You know, like, hey, man, there's a spot in this band or there's a, you know, whatever it is. You do the fucking work.
Right.
You don't walk in and like, hey, I'm here. I'm entering, you know, so what is it that you all do?
Right.
Well, and how can I, how can I fit in here? No, man. No, no. You serious? If you're serious about your empathy, you're serious about your curiosity, and especially if you can, if you're serious about your desire to connect, your desire to demonstrate solidarity, you go off and do the work on your own. And then you come prepared. It's not to say that you're going to know everything. No, you're not. Hell no. But you're not going to be making it a requirement of someone else to say, oh, so what should this say? Right. So, well, the reason that I say that, I don't say this at all as a slighter at all or a slap on your friend.
No, but this is the work for me.
But what I'm saying is that to me, when I presented that curatorial statement to those folks, and this sister said to me, this part right here, I regard her as my sister, the way I regard you as my brother. Our family is like so big and vast, and there's so many different parts. And as it stretches further out, we got like people in Kentucky. We got people in fucking Tanzania. We got people like all over. I don't know what their experience is, but I know that we're connected. I know that we're connected. So the thing that's important for me is to always be mindful of our connection. And when I hear questions like, hey, did you always feel this way? Or did you know about it? What it feels connected to me is a larger cultural context in this country, and not just in this country, but in the West, of a separation. About you, what's this like for you? See, what I'm interested in is the we. And there is a you and a me in the we, but it's right. We're not separated that way where you are having like, no, man, I'm not interested in anything that has to do with spectator. I'm not interested in anything that has to do with the passivity, the passiveness. I'm interested in, hey, I'm right up here with you. What can I do to be present? What can I do to be of service, et cetera?
Well, right. And so, yeah, I guess I feel like the horn. I feel like that's what you're saying is that I need to finish the interview because I have something to do with 7. So it's like, I don't know what you want me to say. If you want to put words in my mouth,
I'm not trying to get you to say anything.
Right.
I'm just sharing with you what my philosophy is.
Right. And that's why I was nervous about this conversation, because I knew that you were going to go deep and that I'd be like, what to say, except for I agree with you. I think, but I don't know. I have to watch and re-listen to what you said to understand, the complexity of what you're saying, because I don't have the same experience as you. That's all. And it's not the way I grew up. I grew up playing tennis and like in a country club and shit. I don't fucking know. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't fucking pay attention to this shit.
Okay, well, the thing is for me that I don't, I guess to just speak frankly from a place of love, I could give a shit where anybody came from. It's all, we all come from where we come from. We come from the situations and the lives and the relationships and so forth and everything. It's just a question of, is there a point at which a person becomes radicalized and understands that that the greatest investment we can make is in humanity. And it's not based on like getting shit or getting over or keeping other people over here, you know, or fighting forces of change. It's about respecting and elevating and connecting with life, with like all of this like abundance of life, man. And, you know, and that comes at a cost. That work, it's work. It's work that it comes at a cost. So, you know, for me, when a person becomes radicalized to that mindset, and to be more explicit, you know, when a person comes to a mindset that like, oh, this person is nothing like me, and they are just as human and they're just as valuable as me. And whatever their ethnicity, whatever their gender, whatever their gender orientation, whether they have a, you know, incredible home or whether they're homeless, they're, this person is just as important and valuable. Beautiful. And not only are they that, not only are they just as valuable and as human as me, as invaluable and as human as me, but we're actually connected. Okay. All right. So I now have that awareness. Okay. That's a radicalization that's not the drumbeat of much of the society and much of the culture. So it's a radicalization. And once you come to that, then the next question for me is, okay, you know, I respect everybody as like a person. I'm not holding hate, racism, misogyny, any of these things against anybody. I truly, you know, okay, great. Now, let's understand that this person over here, who I respect as a person, and may even love as a person, you know, as an idea, even as a person, that their human experience may be completely different than mine because they can get stopped at a traffic light and killed.
Right.
That ain't gonna happen to me. So now that I know that, what am I gonna do about it? Now I can stay over here and be like, hey, I know I respect this person as a human being. I'm not harboring racism or anything. Okay, but what am I gonna do about it? What am I going to do about the fact that this person who I, you know, whether I know them or not, they can be pulled over and shot and killed and they're gone.
Right.
So am I prepared to, invest myself and address that issue?
Yeah, are you?
I have to be. And each of us has a different part to play for any number of reasons. I heard somebody break it down once and say that there are people who bring heat and there are people who bring light. Okay.
Right. Okay.
And in that regard, I'm in the light category.
Right.
You know, I'm not in the heat category. It's not, I'm not made that way. And I'm old as fuck and all of these other things. People who are out in the street bringing heat, more power. I have my own part to play. And I'm true to playing that part. And I got other shit, man. Listen, man, let me show you something. I still fucking sit around and read comic books.
Right.
And enjoy
cool.
them.
Yeah, cool.
Man. And enjoy cool. them. You know?
Right.
But I also have no illusions about the fact that I, through whatever it is about me and the universe, whatever, you know, I get to create relationships with, you know, WNYC Radio, with the Guggenheim Museum, with the Borough of Brooklyn, with the Greenwood Cemetery.
Right, you're good with that shit.
This is, you know, but I have a purpose.
Yeah.
My purpose is to advance my views and beliefs and ideas about humanity and equality and democracy and justice. And this is what I bring into any situation. Now, I still like to come home, read a comic book. I still, if somebody told me that there's like this incredible horror movie that's on, it's like a real horror movie and not a piece of shit. Oh, yeah, that's okay, let's do it, man. I'm there.
But the reality is that in the end,
I also have this commitment.
Right. All right. You're not gonna let me talk.
So anyway, go ahead. The reality of what?
No, I mean I can't go much longer, Brian. I love you so much. So I usually at the end, if you've been kind of being brilliant this whole time, is there anything you want to tell the world? You know, I don't know if there's like a final statement or something, but I mean,
I got a statement. Come to my next thing,
which is
this launches in like day after tomorrow, in 2 weeks. My next big project is called New American Dream, 5 weeks of virtual town halls on disrupting systemic racism and envisioning the nation beyond it. And each week we look at systemic racism, white supremacy, and state-sponsored xenophobia through a different lens. First week is around voting rights and political mobilization. The second week is around artificial intelligence and genetic data. The third week is around Black journalism. The fourth week is around white anti-racism. And the fifth week is around cultural narratives. And the people are fucking amazing, as you know.
Yeah, cool.
My curatorial practice focuses on women. So 90% of these people are women. And this is like the fucking X-Men and the Avengers and the Justice League all together in one thing. It's going to be fucking major. So if,
fucking so great commercial, man.
Tell your people, go to 13.org/New American Dream. This ain't even popped yet, man. Nobody has this information yet. The sites, everything is all built, but we haven't promoted it. Go to 13.org/New American Dream. And there's like all of this information about all this shit. So it's from April 28th through May 26th on Wednesday nights, 5 o'clock live stream. And it's going to be fucking awesome.
Bravo. Thank you, Brian. And love you, man. Thanks for being here today, everybody. Brian Tate. Absolutely amazing, and we love you, and I can't wait to check out that stream. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, man, listen, next time we powwow, podcast, whatever, we should just talk about music, because that's like a whole other thing.
Right. Well, we talked about music.
Yeah, we talked about music.
Yeah, we can do it again. We'll do another one. When you come on, we'll just talk about your whatever. All right, love you, brother. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Peace. All right.
Peace.
All right, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Constant Constance. Tune in every week for new conversations. And if you want even more, check out Andrew's Patreon for more exclusive content and additional conversations. Hosted and produced by Andrew D'Angelo. Edited and mixed by Lucy Little. Original music by Andrew D'Angelo and Maximilian Moore D'Angelo. Intro is Henrietta Weeks. Thanks so much. See you next time.
You fucking beautiful. Yeah, you fucking rocked it. Like,
you
she doesn't know she says podcast, right? Like, she doesn't even